I'm pulling on my driveway. We all know what that means. It's time for another drive to work. Okay, so today I'm talking about batching. So I'm gonna talk about the history of batching, why we do batching, what the value of batching is, what batching is, if you don't know what batching is. So let me start with that. What is batching? So batching is the tool where we list a bunch of different things together, but then make a vocabulary word that goes in the rules text that says, oh, do thing X. And then in the reminder text, we define what it is. And batching by definition means that there's usually two to five items that we're connecting together. So let me walk through the history of batching, and then I'll get into why batching is an important tool for us. Okay, so the story goes back to Dominaria. So we were returning to the place that started it all. So when Magic first began, the main setting was Dominaria, and in the first 10 years of Magic, the vast majority of sets took place in Dominaria. Not everyone, but most of them did. Even though we had a multiverse to explore, we didn't do a lot of multiverse exploring early on. So anyway, after Time Spiral, where we had the mending, we basically had messed up Dominaria quite a bit. It was a little post-apocalyptic. We ended up going off and starting really building a multiverse of just spending years going to other worlds. So by the time we decided to go back to Dominaria, 13 years magic-wise had happened. I think a lot more than that in story. And so at this point, we had more gotten in the habit of making worlds have a certain feel to them, a certain mechanical definition. That part of the fun of a multiverse is that each world really felt distinct from the other. And Dominaria was a bit weird because we had so many sets, like 40 sets have been in Dominaria, that it didn't feel like one thing. It felt like lots of different things. And we wanted to sort of have a cohesive, like when we visit Dominaria, what is it about? We didn't want it to just be random. We wanted it to be about something. So we spent a lot of time in exploratory design and eventually came up with the idea of history. The neat thing about Dominaria is, in the world of Dominaria, a lot of important story things happen there. The Brothers' War happened there. The Phyrexian invasion happened there. The mending happened there. A lot of like big story moments happened there. So it was definitely a world where a lot of famous things happen, and from a in a narrative game sense, like the players experienced all that because they were sets. So there's a history within the game, within the story of the game, and there's a history of the game itself. And so the flavor of Dominaria being about history, the line we used was, a world that's present is defined by its past, was sort of the line we used. And a lot of the way we designed it is there were a lot of the, like, there were ships from the Phyrexian invasion that it's crashed and then the world had built around them. And so a lot of what how we saw the world had to do with things from the past. Okay, but if the world's about history, we wanted to mechanically represent history. And that was a challenge. One of the biggest problems is the low-hanging fruit of history is the graveyard. It represents spells of the past, right? But we had done Amonkhet not long before, and Amonkhet had really done a lot with the graveyard. And before Amonkhet, like we had done a lot of stuff with the graveyard in that time period, so we didn't want to use the graveyard. We wanted to do something different. So we made a list of things we felt like what could represent history. So one of the ideas we liked was artifacts. Artifacts, even the name artifacts, right? They're objects of the past, of usually of some historical importance, magical items mostly. We also liked the idea that there were characters, some of which might still be alive just because it's a fantasy, and so, we might have a tree folk that's thousands, or a dragon, or somebody that's thousands of years old. That could happen in fantasy. And we also wanted to do a lot of like ancestors. Like this famous person is no longer alive, but their ancestor. Gerard is dead, but his ancestor lives on. And so we liked the idea of that legendary creatures were a tie to the past. Finally, we had invented something new for Dominaria. We wanted to represent stories. And so we ended up using some early designs we had done for planeswalkers that had felt a little too predictive. Like, we wanted planeswalkers to have agency, and we came up with this mechanic where the planeswalkers did things in a certain order, and it felt like the planeswalkers were dumb. Like, for example, one of the very first ones we made was Garrick, and it was like, on turn one, he makes a wolf, or not wolf, a beast. He makes a 3/3 beast. On turn two, for every beast he has, he makes another beast. He duplicates all his beasts. And then on turn three, all beasts get +3 and trample. But the problem is, turn one, I make a beast, and then your opponent, like, bolts it or something. Turn two, he does nothing. There's nothing to copy. Turn three, well, he gives all beasts plus two plus three, but there's no beast, so he doesn't do anything. So he was sitting around twiddling his thumbs, and it felt like he didn't have agency, that he just felt dumb. But when we were trying to come up with stories, we realized that having a set pattern, hey, that's what a story is. Hey, chapter one happens in chapter two, then chapter three. So that same mechanic that didn't feel right for planeswalkers felt right for stories. We came up with a new way to lay them out. They were vertical images. Anyway, we built a lot into them, and we decided that we'd also include sagas on our list. So the idea originally was, okay, I think Aaron's the one that suggested this first. What if we just took, like, early on in the file, we just cared about those three things. Some things cared about artifacts. Some things cared about legendary things. Some things cared about sagas. But it was a little mishy-mashy. So I think Aaron was the one that said, well, what if we just put them together? And so, okay, when this creature enters the battlefield, you can return an artifact or a legendary card or a saga from the graveyard to your hand. Or whenever you cast an artifact or a legendary card or a saga from your hand, this trigger happens. It was just wordy. And the other problem was that people weren't getting it, right? We're like, well, we chose these three things because they represent history. But it wasn't quite coming across. I think we... So anyway, what happened was... So Bill Rose is the VP of R&D. Bill Rose, from time to time, this is a ways back. He's less involved day to day. But he would look at sets, just sort of give a sign-off on them. And he didn't understand the history part. He didn't understand the three connector things. And so he, like, I don't get this. Like, why are these together? And I'm like, well, it represents history. And so we did a little bit of testing. And Bill's gut was sort of true. The majority of people we tested with, like, didn't get why it came together. And Bill was like, yeah, it's not coming through. We should just pull it from the set. So I was like, no, Bill. It's important to the set. I think it's the glue that holds everything together. Let me see if I can convey it better. Maybe there's better ways to convey what we're doing. And Bill said, okay. I think he gave me a month or 2 months. He gave me a deadline. Said, well, look, I'll give you this long, but if you don't figure it out by then, we really got to change it up. It's not working for the set. And so I said, okay. So I put together a little strike team. Kelly Diggs was the creative representative, and I forget who the art director was, but me and Kelly and the art director, like, so what I did was I would try something, and then I would test it around the building and see, do you understand what's going on? And I would test with different people because a lot of it was first impression, so I would test with different people. So we tried a bunch of different things. First things, we tried ability words, where I'm like, it's history, colon, whenever an artifact let you know. But what I found was people really got hung up on the objects, and, like, we were having a lot of trouble. And, like, every time we did something, we would increment it a little bit. We spent some time, like, being more exacting in the flavor. We're like, what are the tropes you want to hit? Oh, this is a adventurous archaeologist, and they care about the past. So, like, we would find things that sort of were more resonant. We started playing with technology of how we worded it. But no matter what I did, I could increment it up. I was making it, like, more people got it, but not enough people got it. And I think we were down to, like, a week left. And so I said, okay, let me try something bolder. So what I did is I said, okay, I'm not going to reference the three things in the rule text. I'm just going to put a flavorful word there. So we used historic. So it says, when this enters the battlefield, put a historic card from your graveyard into your hand, or whenever you cast a historic card, trigger, right? I just took them out. I'm like, I'm just going to put a flavorful word in the rules text. I'm not in the rules text. I'm not going to worry about what it means. I'm just going to use a flavorful word. And then in reminder text, well, I have to tell you what that means, so I'll tell you in reminder text. But the idea was it made it much lighter, shorter, pithier, and it just made the flavor word, like, front and center. I get a historic card. That sounds great. Okay, what's a historic card? And then I would tell you what it was. And by offsetting the list outside of the rules text, so that when you read the rules text, like, once you learned it, you could just ignore the list. It popped, and it solved the problem. So, like, as often happens with magic, sometimes you invent something because you're trying to solve a problem. And then when you invent it, you're like, oh, this is pretty cool. So that was the first use of batching, was historic in Dominaria. So let me talk a little bit about the value of batching. Why did once we did it once, I realized it was something very valuable. Why is it valuable? Well, number one is one of the largest problems that we have right now is, I don't know, 10, 15 years ago, Commander became pretty dominant. And along with it, modern, like Magic used to live in Standard. Like Standard was like the heart of Magic. More Standard was played than any other constructed format. Now that's not true. Now, at least in tabletop, Commander's the most played format. I think Modern is second. So a lot of people are playing with a lot more older cards. So one of the problems is, a lot of making Magic is we make brand new things. But if that brand new things requires you to have enough cards to play, it becomes problematic, especially in Commander. So Commander, normal outside Commander, most of the formats are four of 60 card formats, non-limited formats. So you have 60 cards and you can have four of each one. So in order to have a theme work, you only need 8 to 10 cards maybe. You know, that those cards, when you have four of them, you know, that's enough to make it work. I mean, maybe even a little less than 8 can make it work, but like 6 to 10, you can make it work. But in Commander, it's not four of, it's one of, it's not 60 cards, it's 100 cards. So the math is something like you need 6.5 times as many cards to make a theme work. It's a lot harder if you want to build around a new theme to just make enough cards. Even when we're making blocks, we weren't making enough cards. And so that's one of the problems is, a lot of times we introduce something and it's brand new. I'll use energy as a perfect example. We introduce energy. Energy is fun. There are plenty of energy cards to make an energy deck in four of 60 card formats. But in Commander, there just weren't enough cards, let alone the problem that you have color identity and sometimes, you know, a deck can't even play all the colors. So even if we make a lot of cards, because of color identity, you can only play ones in your color identity. It just, and we're just, the volume you need is so high. Now, hey, energy, we started doing more energy eventually again in the Fallout decks and in Modern Horizons 3. And we're starting to get to the point where there's maybe enough energy that you can build, you know, you can build a Commander deck out of it. But that was like many years later with multiple sets. And so what we refer to as sort of a parasitic mechanic. What a parasitic mechanic is you kind of need stuff from that set to play it. And, you know, the one thing that we were very conscious of was we can make some parasitic things, that Magic can do that, but the problem you run into is if all your sets are that, it just becomes hard to play with new themes. We want the audience to, like, embrace the new set and play in the new themes, but if the new set is too narrow in its volume, in its number, it's hard to play that in larger format, especially in Commander. So one of the things we're looking for is, how do we make new themes that use old components? How do we make a new theme that has enough cards that you can build around? And the nice thing about batching is, I'll take Historic as my example, Magic has had artifacts since the very beginning of the game. Magic has had legendary things since early in the game. I mean, not the first thing, but Legends, the third set, had it. So since early in the game, you could do that. So the biggest question is, and then sagas were new, but that also shows that batching can mix old and new. And ironically, sagas have gone on to become deciduous, so sagas aren't quite as hard to do as they once were. There's a lot more of them. Anyway, so that's one big thing batching does. It allows you to do new themes with old components, and it allows you, like, one of the things that we're constantly doing is, look, every time you make new sets, we're adding new qualities, and that when you get into eternal formats, there's a lot going on. So when we can reuse existing things, that's just very valuable. And we've done a lot of, hey, it's an enchantment set. Hey, it's an artifact set. Hey, like, we can do those themes, but, like, the low-hanging fruit singular themes we have done. You know, there's not a lot of things that every Magic set has that we haven't made a set that cared about those things. There just isn't that many of those things, and we make a lot of Magic sets. So the other thing that batching did is kind of broaden up what we could care about in a way that was useful. Okay, so what happened is we put batching in Dominaria. I was excited by it right away. I definitely saw the value of it. So I was working on Zendikar Rising. So that set came out a number of years later. And one of the things about Zendikar is that Zendikar is an adventure world. And we borrowed the one of the big influences on adventure world was Dungeons & Dragons. For a lot of players, a lot of, game players, it is the place that they've interacted with that has the most of some adventure world feel. So when we made original Zendikar, we made the allies that represented the parties. One of the big things in D&D is you have adventure parties where, and there are different classes in D&D. The four original classes, originally they were fighter, wizard, rogue, thief, and cleric. Now, more classes have been added since then, but those were kind of the original four. And so when we made original Zendikar, we made allies, we made different kinds of allies, and that we made them wizard, rogue, because our thieves are rogue, and thieves not called rogue. Fighters became warriors, and then clerics were clerics. Wizard and cleric, obviously, are creature types. And so we kind of cared. Wizard tended to cast spells that were scalable things, counting allies, that were positive for you. Rogues tended to do scaling things that affected your opponent. Warriors were things that tended to affect you in combat. Anyway, we sort of used them very lightly. They existed there as creature types, but we were very light with it. When we went back to Zendikar, it was Battle for Zendikar. There was a whole big story about dealing with the Eldrazi. That took up a lot of the return, introduced the Gatewatch and stuff. But anyway, the Eldrazi, by the end of that story, were dealt with. So on our third trip to Zendikar, we wanted to kind of return to the glory that was Zendikar. And we wanted to really lean into the kind of D&D feel that we'd had in the first run. Within a year, we would make a D&D set for the first time, Dungeons & Dragons Adventures of the Forgotten Realm. We didn't know we were doing that when we started making Zendikar. So one of the ideas we were doing just to do something a little bit different was this idea of making your party. So we made the party mechanic, and the party mechanic really wanted to use four things. Like I said, we wanted to have our version of fighters, wizards, thieves, and clerics. So we made a mechanic, and we could batch those four things. And the idea was, hey, I need to have these things, and as long as I have one of each, I get a count in. And then mostly they were scalable. Some of them were threshold, meaning you only had to have a certain number. Some of them upgraded a bit if you had all four. But anyway, we used the party mechanic, and it made use of the batching idea of, hey, you're making a party, and then we'll define in the definition what a party is. Now, the definition is super flavorful. So one of the rules we had made on batching is that the things you batch together have to be very flavorful. Like the player has to be able to remember them. And we said, in order to remember them, let's just do 2 to 5. But 5 is about the most you could remember. 3 was the sweet spot. You'll notice that we did 3 in with Historic. We ended up doing 4 with Party, just because there were 4 members to the party, so that's what we were hitting. The next time we did it was when I was doing Zendikar Rising. Aaron asked me to, he wanted to say, I was pitching the idea that we do modal double face cards in all 3 sets, in Zendikar Rising, in Kaldheim, and in Strixhaven. And Aaron wanted to see what that would look like. So I mocked up decks. I made pre-constructed decks for each of the 3 sets. Now, Zendikar Rising, we were doing design on, so I could actually borrow mechanics from it. We hadn't made anything yet for Kaldheim or for Strixhaven, so I designed some stuff. I mean, I made up some double face cards, obviously, but I also, so the mechanic I made for Kaldheim, or one of them, was modified. And the time modified just meant if you were enchanted or equipped. That's what it originally meant. And I put that in, so we ended up putting that into Kaldheim, and ended up not making it to print, at least with a name. I think there were a few cards that referenced it, but it didn't have an official name. And then when we were working on Kamigawa and Neon Dynasty, so I led the vision design for that, Dave led the set design, and Dave was the person who had done Kaldheim. And so anyway, it came up that we both knew modified. So when Dave works, Dave is on the visions of teams that he's going to lead the set design for. So it came up that when we came up with the modernity versus tradition of Neon Dynasty, we liked the idea that modernity was artifacts and tradition was enchantments, and we were looking for overlaps between those. Like, what's the middle ground, right? That what if you draft some of one side and some of the other? And one of the ideas we realized is we had equipment and auras, and so we liked the idea of, well, what if I just care about being, something's attached to you, that's what I care about. So we remembered that mechanic, we brought it back. In set design, Dave would add counters to it just because counters have the same feel, right? I'm boosting the creature and counters also boost the creature. So modified ended up being there. And modified says, oh, if I have an aura on me, aura that I control, I believe, an equipment or a counter on me, I get a bonus. I'm modified. And so that ended up being there. The fourth place we've done it, at least as far as release material, is in Outlaws of Thunder Junction. We originally were trying an outlaw creature type. The problem was it was just very parasitic. Like, if I cared about the outlaw creature type, then the only cards I could care about were in the set. And look, we kind of had words that reference, you know, like Rogue was kind of similar to outlaw. So we said, oh, what if we use batching technology? And the idea I liked is we needed a rogue. Rogue had the backward compatibility. Assassin felt like, how do you not do assassins? And we were doing mercenaries in the set as a creature token. So I'm saying, okay. So we made a list of all the things that could be outlaws. I think there was like 10 things. Maybe berserker, maybe ninja, maybe pirate. Like, we listed a bunch of stuff. We decided that the absolutes for me were assassin and rogue and mercenary. Mercenary mostly given the confines of the set, what we need to do in the set. We were using mercenaries a lot as our minions. And so I needed to have that in the set. I then went to Doug, who was in charge of the creative. And Doug said, look, it's magic. We have a lot of spell casting. You know, magic is core to this. We need to have a outlaw, something in the outlaw batch needs to care about casting spells. Because the design team said, this is an outlaw, the creative team needed to make sure they can make it an outlaw. And just casting a spell, so Doug suggested Warlock. We'd added Warlock in during Throne of Eldraine, and it was kind of the dark spellcaster. They're definitely the ones up to no good. And so making Warlock outlaws made sense, and it gave the creative team freedom to do what they needed. We handed over with those four, knowing that we could go to five, because I like to give set design some flexibility. If they needed to add something, like I said, there were other things we had listed that could possibly be there. It turns out Lost Caverns Ixalan had added pirates to play into Ixalan. And so there were a bunch of pirates in Standard. And it just, people felt like pirates felt like they made sense in the Outlaw. So they added pirates in. So Outlaw ended up being five. Like I said, that's the upper limits. So it was assassins and rogues and mercenaries and warlocks and pirates. So I will say this, I can't go into specifics. There's more batching coming in the future. Batching has proved very valuable. Once again, the key to batching is they need to make sense. They need to be flavorful and they need to be something that we want. Like, once you label it, you then can mechanically care about it. So we have to want to mechanically care about it. The other nice thing about it is one of the challenges when we do typal themes is just getting the volume of cards, getting enough cards that it matters. And the cool thing about batching, not that all are batching necessarily is creature type, but it does allow some freedom like with Outlaw. And it also allows us to take disconnected things and make new themes, like what Historic does. You know, Historic is taking different card types or subtypes and combining them. So there's just neat things we can do with it. So that is something that we will definitely look forward in the future. So like, I can't promise that anything that currently has batching in it will be printed with batching because they're not out yet. But I can see how we're using it, and I do believe more batches will make it. Since we have a little bit of time, I'm almost to work, I will talk about the Mega Batch, an experiment of something we tried in Bloomborough that did not work out. So I want to talk a little bit about the ideas behind the Mega Batch. So I've talked a lot about how the batching, we like to do 2 to 5 items because you got to remember them. But I was very intrigued by the idea of, could we do something bigger? Could we do a batch that is more than 5 things? In fact, so big that we wouldn't write it on the card. There wouldn't be space to write it on the card. But we could define it on the card in a way that people would get it. And while we were making Bloomborough, the main theme of Bloomborough is animals. And I was like, animals are pretty that's a pretty universal thing. Like, I felt like if I show you a magic card and go, is this an animal? Probably you'll get that right. Like, you know, people know what animals are. And so we tried to make an animal mega batch, meaning we make cards that say something like animals are +1/+1. And then anything that's an animal would get counted. And the idea was that people would know when it. So we had there were some issues with doing this. First off, I went and talked to Jess. Jess Dunks is the rules manager. And I'm like, can we do a mega batch? And Jess said, from a rule standpoint, there needs to be a definitive list. As long as there's a definitive list, the rules can say, well, here's the list. It was fine. Whether or not that list fit on a card wasn't a rules issue. There are things we do in the rules where the card just says, hey, go look at the rules. It's not all, we can't fit it on the card. There are things we put in the rules. And the idea behind the mega batch was, hey, it's intuitive that people can understand. They don't need to list it, that you would know it. So the first, we ran into a couple things we had to define. First off, are humans animals? We decided no. There's a lot of humans, and really the fun of animals isn't humans. I get technically, you know, in flora and fauna, you know, I mean, we're, what are we, fauna? Are we flora is plants, is that right? Or fauna is plants? No, fauna is plants. We're flora. Anyway, humans are technically animals, but not in the sense that we were talking about. A lot of times you think of animals as being not human. So anyway, we said not human. We also said, look, it gets fuzzy when you get into fictional things. You know, is an elemental an animal? Is like, when you start getting into fictional things that aren't real, it's tricky because we've made them up. So I said, okay, real earth animals. Like, I could go to a zoo on earth and I could see this animal. And so that meant not just not fantasy animals, but not even fantasy animals made up of real animals. There's a bunch of fantasy animals that, like, I'm part this and part that. You know, there's a lot of, like, Greek mythology stuff, like a manticore. That's like, it's different animal parts or chimeras or whatever. But, okay, we're saying, no, that's fantasy. You have to be an actual animal that existed. Then we get stuff like, the dinosaurs count? Like, okay, dinosaurs were on Earth. They were an animal. Okay, has existed on Earth. Doesn't have to currently be alive. So just, if you go to extinct, that doesn't remove you from being an animal. And then we got a lot of other questions. Is a germ an animal? Is an egg an animal? Is a beast an animal? And we answered those questions, but it definitely, and the tricky one, the one that I always bring up was, so in the game, we use serpent, the creature type serpent, to mean sea monster. If you're a serpent, if you're a normal snake, you're snake. But if you're a sea monster, you're a serpent. But the word serpent is synonymous with snake. Meaning if I said to somebody, is a serpent an animal? They would say yes, because on Earth, a serpent is an animal. That's not how we use the word, but we felt like it was confusing to say to somebody, hey, is a serpent an animal? Because you go, yeah, a serpent's an animal. So we ended up putting that on the list. But my point is, there was a lot of fuzziness. 95% of it was crystal clear. Is a rabbit an animal? Yes, it is. Is a wolverine an animal? Yes, it is. You know, is a mouse an animal? Yes, it is. So the idea was, I mean, just an example of us trying to push in other areas. What three things ended up killing the number one was the stuff I'm sort of explaining. It wasn't as clear. There was a lot of fuzziness. Yeah, most of it was clear, but as with any rules, the fuzziness matters. The germ, the egg, the serpent, all that matters. And even if we came up with answers, there's just education. Part of the coolness of a mega was it's so intuitive that you don't need the list. But when the list gets confusing, oh, you kind of need the list. And so there's that problem. Problem number two was there was an upkeep problem. Normally when we make rules, okay, we've made the rules, we write them, we're done. The rules are done. Maybe we adapt the rules in the future if other rules run the way. But this list said, hey, for now till the end of the game, there's a list that we have to update every time we make a creature type. Every time we make a creature type, we have to go, is that an animal? And if so, we got to add it to the list. And the idea was we want to be careful not to make mechanics that just have forever going upkeep. One in a vacuum might seem okay, but once we say you can do that, we start getting in this world where we just make more and more upkeep, and that can be problematic. The third problem was animals ended up being a pretty large subsection, and the reaction from a lot of play design was, it's not that hard to do that. It's not that hard to make an all-animal deck, and a lot of it to me was the charm, oh, it's an animal deck, and I only used animals, but it was a big enough subset that it wasn't that much of a challenge, so Anyway, for those three reasons, we did not do the Mega Batch. But I like the idea of the Mega Batch. The fact that animals didn't work, and animals was like a prime category of something very intuitive. I don't know if a Mega Batch will work. I'm not saying I'm against the idea, but a Mega Batch by definition will have upkeep costs. So I don't know whether we'll be able to make a Mega Batch work. A lot of the problems that came up with Animal will come up again. So anyway, just showing the reason I bring up the Mega Batch is Batch is an interesting tool. I like it in our toolbox. I will keep exploring what it can do. Can we use batching in ways we haven't used before? Turns out the Mega Batch didn't work, but the idea behind it was a cool idea. So anyway, guys, that is batching. Like I said, it is one of the things about magical design is we have to keep making new things, and so we keep having to find new tools to make new things. And so sometimes when you make something, not only do you make it by itself, but you realize that it's a tool that you can use. And batching is one of the more recent tools that we've created, and a really interesting one. I will say before I leave, we can overuse batching. We can do batching in a way that's not great. We can make batches that aren't intuitive. We have to be careful. We don't want endless batching. I do understand that batching puts some sort of load on memory when you start getting to larger formats. So we need to be careful when and where and how. We're trying to make sure that our batches are very flavorful, and so that they, a lot of it is, if I just said to you, you didn't even read the reminder text, what would it be? We want to make things that are pretty clean. So that is something we're working on. Our bar to making batches has gotten pretty high. Anyway, guys, that is everything I have to say about batching. And I'm at work, so we all know what that means. It means it's the end of my drive to work. So instead of talking magic, it's time for me to be making magic. I'll see you guys next time. Bye-bye.